Hello there, welcome along to Proper Supporters WWE episode 16. It's a bit of a themed one, this one, Richard. It's, Brian Pillman.
Yeah, well, nothing else has happened this week, but...
Well, a lot's happened in regards.
Lots of things have happened this week, but there's also a new book out called Crazy Like a Fox. It's not about Alicia Fox, it's about Brian Pillman, and it's by Liam O'Rourke, and we will be speaking to him later on the podcast.
It's about, what, 20 years on?
20 years since he died, yeah, October the 5th, 1997.
Mm. And you've been speaking to the author, Liam...
Yes.
O'Rourke.
Liam O'Rourke, yeah, and you know, in 1997, the internet was not as widespread as it is today.
Yeah.
So I only found out by... Because the In Your House shows weren't on Sky in those days. Mm. And I think we had Sky in 1997 anyway, because we were, you know, didn't have the money to waste on lots of channels. So I think I only found out by... What I used to do is go around to my grandma's, ring the Power Slam hotline to get the results.
Power Slam?
Yeah, it's a magazine. To get the results of In Your House.
Did this cost...
Yeah, it was like 50p a minute.
So good,
like,
Lord!
I'd give my grandma £3 to listen to it. And that's how I learned how he'd passed away.
Proper kayfabe days, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that's that was in the olden days. But now we've got the internet, so we just know, everyone knows what's going on now. So
makes
life easier.
Definitely. We'll be talking, like we said, then to Liam very shortly. Richard's had a great sit-down chat with him. That's coming up, and we'll be talking a little bit more about Brian Pillman in a bit. But, of course, it's the Prop Sport Does WWE... And we're going to review the week in WWE,
yes.
Post-Survivor Series. And the big news, obviously, that we're going to have to talk about is that the return of Paige, which we predicted would be happening at Survivor Series. It wasn't. It was the night after.
Yes.
And she's returned to Raw, obviously. First off, right call, putting her on Raw?
Yeah, why not? It's the bigger show, isn't it? Even though we're not supposed to think that.
Well,
and she's a very popular character and always has been since she was called up to the main roster from NXT. So she fits on there, doesn't she? It'd be interesting to see where they go. And that's the intrigue, isn't it? Because obviously she was very popular. But surely, with her cohorts, if you will, she's a heel, isn't she?
You'd hope so. Maybe. I think she works well as a heel. I think she works very well as a heel.
Yeah,
I'm glad she came back and the reaction was... the one she got given. Because
yeah, well, I don't think it was going to be anything other than that.
No.
To be honest.
And
I don't think WWE fans generally are like that.
You know, no.
They're, I know you get those...
You get them in the comments section and things, but don't get them in this actual...
Yeah,
building.
But it's... We've been to house shows, and I know it's different from going to watch Raw or whatever.
Yeah.
But you're there to have fun and a good time, and most people generally aren't there to get themselves over and act like dicks. You know, most people there to enjoy themselves, and you know, that's what the crowd did. So they were pleased to see her back because they like her and she's been away for a long time. So it's good to see her back.
Definitely. The fact that she's come back, though, with two NXT call-ups,
yes,
which turns out to be actually two of five,
yeah,
which we'll talk about in the SmackDown section. But when it came to Raw, interfering in the match between Bayley and, it was a fatal four-way match.
Yeah.
I've forgotten exactly who.
Generic throwaway. Well, it doesn't matter, does it? Because it didn't matter in the end.
Yeah, Sonya Deville and Mandy Rose.
Yeah, I can't say
two NXT stars. Mandy Rose, when I've watched her, I think she's been very talented, and I think she's got the capabilities of being a really good heel.
Yeah,
I'm not overly familiar with Deville, but she strikes me whenever I've seen her as a MMA sort of style.
That's her gimmick, isn't it? Which is interesting because, of course, they've got a proper MMA fighter in Shayna Baszler.
Yeah.
but more of that to come in the coming weeks and months, as we know what's going to happen at WrestleMania. So yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting why those, and say why not the iconic duo.
There's calls for that because
you'd have thought
out of all the five that they called up, the iconic duo were probably the most likely contenders to come up.
Well, they seem
Peyton Royce definitely.
Well, they fit better together. These two just seem to be two people, don't they? Generically,
but it came in, made an impact.
They did,
and that's the whole purpose of it, and it's helping obviously buffer a bit of a stronger women's Rose
as well.
Roster
looks like a young Trish Stratus.
Mm. I think there's no denying.
Very similar. If she can work as well as Trish did, then she'll go okay. We haven't seen much of them in the ring, have we? That's the thing. So,
do you think this is going to be the start of like maybe factions or something? The interesting thing that I've found is this has got to be clearly a build up to the first ever Women's Royal Rumble.
Yeah, there's too many women, no way
you would bring in this many number of women that weren't on the main card before to not have a Women's Royal Rumble. It'd be laughable if they didn't do it now.
Of course. And you might as well change 205 Live into an all-women's show instead. You know, it might get more viewers, I don't know. But there are so many women around now. When we booked our Royal Rumble, was that last week?
No, it was before? two weeks ago.
When we booked
our Royal
Rumble,
you can find it on episode. Yeah. Yeah, you can watch it on episode 14. Watch it? What am I on about? It's a podcast. You listen
watch
to
your
it.
Phone. As we said before, we were getting to around the 20 mark, and now you've got plenty of names, haven't you? So
yeah.
It's interesting. Was that the biggest thing on Raw?
I think it was. There was nothing else other than the fact that,
Roman Reigns won the IC title.
Now, we know why. We know why he won it. It's because The Miz is going off to shoot the Marine Six.
With Becky Lynch.
And Shawn Michaels.
Yeah.
Good luck, Miz. A sick Marine film.
I don't think I've seen any of them.
I watched the first one.
Is it all right?
No.
I think they're always on Sky, aren't they? Like 3 in the morning.
I watched The Condemned as well. You know, the one with Steve Austin?
Yeah.
And also Vinnie Jones, isn't it?
Yeah.
But no... We know that's why he's won the championship, but this is the thing. It just reeks of Raw stands for Roman always wins. And it's one of those things of, Vince clearly sees the Shield is going to try and get him over. The Shield is going to help him become more popular. But the fact is, it's just to fans like, for instance, you and I, we're a bit annoyed of it because it's like, well, no, this could have been given an opportunity to Finn Balor. Or...
Finn Balor.
Someone else.
Samoa Joe.
Yeah, Samoa Joe. And they could help elevate that title, help elevate that mid-card scene. And yet this is probably going to be the package up until Mania. And it might even be a champion versus champion match at WrestleMania, him and Brock, which we don't want. Anyway.
So The Miz, right, I didn't realise he'd won 7 Intercontinental titles.
That's a lot.
He is third on the list of combined reigns and all that. But I only realised he'd won so many when WWE tweeted out a thing yesterday saying, look at this gallery of former Intercontinental Champions. And I got so far in and I got bored. And it generally is, here's Roman Reigns, here's The Miz, here's Dean Ambrose, here's The Miz, here's Dolph Ziggler, here's The Miz. And then you go back, I can't remember Ryback winning the IC title.
One of the WrestleManias, I think he was going for it against... No, he wasn't. That was Kalisto. I'm getting confused. Although I do remember Ryback with the title.
At least that was the US title, I think.
Exactly. Sorry about that.
Bad News Barrett, 5. I remember Big E
Langston. He won the championship 5 times. Yeah. And yet, for me, he had all the talent.
This is our going off on a tangent bit, ladies and gentlemen. Curtis Axel, do you remember when he won it?
No.
Or Big E?
I do, actually, because it was, I think...
When it was Big E Langston?
Yeah, was it just after Dolph? And he just turned face?
Cody Rhodes.
He's been great. Cody. IC champ. He really has.
Ezekiel Jackson.
No.
Kofi Kingston.
Okay, let's move on.
That's like JBL was on there. Like, I have no recollection of JBL being the Intercontinental champion.
No. So that's it for Raw, really. I don't think there's actually too much else we need to talk about. I think, obviously...
Well, the starting bit was, we're supposed to all talk about it, but it's one of those boring opening segments, wasn't it?
Sorry, of course, about Kurt and Triple H, obviously, clearly building up to something, whether it's the Royal Rumble or Mania, remains to be seen, because
everyone,
I think it's going
to
be
Triple H.
Yeah. Oh, in 2017,
Jason Jordan's going to turn on Kurt Angle and side with Triple H, isn't he?
Probably. But this is the thing, though. How bad is it that Triple H is your, arguably, the top guy?
Yeah.
That's bad, that. And I like Trips.
Can I just say, I like Dana Brooke. I think she's great. And as a competitor, it was funny.
Yeah. Unlucky.
That was real, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting what they do with Paige and Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville. They seem to be a very... disparate group of 3 people have just been randomly thrown together.
Yeah.
Speaking of disparate groups of 3 people have been randomly thrown together.
The NXT call-ups for SmackDown.
Yeah.
Liv Morgan.
Yep.
Ruby Riott and Sarah Logan. I think Ruby Riott is fantastic. I've seen her in her action. I think she's really good. Liv Morgan's
she's got a different look as well, which is the thing.
Exactly. Liv Morgan, I think it's clear why many guys, and Meltzer said this, 12-year-old boys and boys of teenage boys will like her because she's attractive.
Yeah.
And
37-year-old boys like her as well.
And I think, obviously, she's a pretty decent worker. We'll wait and see. Sarah Logan, I'm not too sure.
I like Sarah Logan. If you remember when we reviewed the Mae Young Classic, I said there was something about her I liked, and I couldn't put my finger on what it was. And I think she's got a personality, and she's obviously the one who's, I think, the most experienced of the three.
Mm.
That's the great thing about when you bring up three people at once, you can do six-man tags and hide people.
Yeah, it's true.
And they can...
It's how the Shield started.
Yeah.
Well, in WWE, certainly.
Yeah. Well, that's what they did with Roman Reigns. That's what you could learn on the job at a higher level, and that's what they've done here with these three. Have you seen Liv Morgan on Twitter having a spat with Carmella?
I have seen that, because apparently they look quite similar and they've got similar gimmicks, kind of. And it was.
I never really got that.
No, I didn't either. But I do quite like the idea of them using that for a storyline and maybe in a match soon. You'd hope.
I don't know if I want to see that match though.
I would want to see it, because I want to see the guy. I want to see the girl. Sorry, I should say, in action. But yeah, I think it struck me as too similar to the Monday Night.
Well, yeah, that was the thing, wasn't it? It was exactly the same.
Exactly
when you say
same.
Too similar, it was exactly the same.
Yeah, do it a little bit different. I don't know how, but
no, I don't know either. But. Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn didn't get fired. Sami Zayn's entrance now is the best thing on television.
I've retweeted it.
It's got wacky.
Yeah, I retweeted it. It's like someone put the Sami Zayn music to Martin Prince running around Nelson Muntz.
Oh, right, yeah.
And just go, da, 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 da. It's quite it's interesting, because it's one of the reasons you want to tune in next week. Well, what's going to happen? It's still not amazing gripping television, but
no.
Whether we'll see if Daniel Bryan does turn heel against Shane, which I doubt will happen.
The problem is Shane's the heel.
He should be the heel.
The Bludgeon Brothers, they're on. They've not got first names anymore.
They're like Kane Jr.
Yeah. Maybe they'll get their names back like Charlotte, because Charlotte was Charlotte, and then she's Charlotte Flair again now.
Should be Charlotte again at some point soon.
Yeah,
I didn't like the idea, by the way, of Kevin Owens being on his hands and knees begging for his job to Daniel Bryan at the end of SmackDown.
Well, he's begging to Daniel Bryan than one of them at Mans.
Yeah.
Because if he'd have been on Raw, he'd have had to kiss Stephanie's feet or something.
Ugh, yeah. But yeah, the Bludgeon Brothers, did they impress you? It was a debut squash match, as expected.
But they're both all right, aren't they?
Yeah, they're good workers. I think Luke Harper's brilliant, actually.
Harper.
For a man of his... Yeah, Harper is, yeah.
Just Harper. Yes, Luke Harper. He's not called Luke anymore.
Oh, sorry. Of course. Yeah, sorry.
Get with the program.
Yeah. And that's just about it, really.
Who's your favourite, Liv Morgan or Carmella? Who do you think would win a fight between the two?
I quite like the idea of Carmella beating Liv Morgan, because it helps further establish her character.
As being FABULOUS.
Yeah, I don't like the fact that they cut the theme from the bit where it's like the dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
They've done that. Okay, before we come on to Brian Pillman and we talk about that, let's talk about some of the big news that happened this week. First, I want to talk about this week in the news. It was announced that the Money in the Bank 2018 will be a co-branded pay-per-view alongside the Big Four.
Cool.
Right decision, because it seems silly, but does this mean 4-4? Money in the Bank ladder matches, does it? Or does it mean two? And so for it to be the only night of the year, other than Survivor Series, where the SmackDown...
Yeah, I think that would be better, wouldn't it? Because if you have
four, it's too much.
Four's too
so
many.
Overkill.
So yeah, and you don't need four briefcases either, do you? You only need two.
That's what I'm saying. They could also make a storyline.
From each show.
Yeah, you could have a storyline of you can cash in on either championship. I think that'd be really cool. So imagine if Carmella ran in with her briefcase now and cashed in on Alexa Bliss.
Yeah.
That would get heat. It'd be really good.
Yeah.
Elsewhere, WWE have filed a trademark for a mixed match challenge.
They come up with some rubbish trademarks at times, don't they?
So this is apparently going to have mixed tag matches of men and women weekly.
Weekly.
Yeah. Unreal.
I don't really know what to say. There's nothing I can say.
I don't really want this to go ahead.
Do not want.
and finally... I've got two more pieces of news. First one was a little bit quick one regarding Finn Balor. Now...
Finn Balor.
He's taken social media by storm this past week.
I'm never sure whether that's a good thing or not, you know, though.
He tweeted out a picture of, I think it was of him wrestling someone. In fact, it was wrestling Roman. Okay.
Yeah.
And he put, Balor Club, hashtag, whatever, and then forever underneath it. But every letter apart from OV and ER were like over. Right? He did the same thing on his Instagram with a picture of him with the turkey. I am not over cooking this turkey, something like that. And he put out a picture on the official WWE website. There was a poll of who should be next to challenge Brock for the title. 64% said Finn Balor.
I'm never sure whether that's a clever thing to do or not.
Why?
Because Vince is Vince, isn't he? He doesn't care what's on the bloody website.
He doesn't care what fans think.
So
how bad is that?
Well, he does, just not about everything. I don't know. It's given a lot of credence to something that a lot of the fans won't know about.
What do you mean?
Well, this all comes from the... Was it on the Wrestling Observer Radio this week? I can't remember which one, but it was in the newsletter on... No, it would have been on the radio because I would have heard it. About the plans changing for the Royal Rumble and it not being Brock and Balor. Because belief was...
He's not over enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you, or he's not, know, but, he's not known enough.
But he's now referring to something which is not within the WWE universe.
Yeah.
So, because don't forget, nothing that happens outside the WWE universe counts.
Yeah.
Unless they want it to count, like world title reigns.
Yeah.
Which don't always count. They never say AJ Styles is a...
multi-time world champion,
NWA world champion, whatever, do they? No.
No.
They say two-time.
Yeah.
They mention his IWGP title.
Because there's...
Because that's not, you know...
Yeah, yeah.
So it's referring to something that isn't referred to. They don't... Michael Cole, when the Wrestling Observer newsletter Hall of Fame is released this week, the class of 2017, if a WWE performer goes in... I'm trying to think who's on the ballot this year. If Edge goes into the Hall of Fame...
Yeah.
Or Randy Orton, more pertinently, although he's on SmackDown. Tom Phillips is not going to come on.
Saying, I understand
Randy
that.
Orton is in the
Fair
Hall
enough.
So it's like referring to something which doesn't count... in a bizarre way. So I don't know why they've done it. It's odd.
Well, no, I think Finn's clearly doing it to provoke a bit
of
reaction.
He's obviously annoyed, isn't he?
But yeah. Well, yeah. But you see it with footballers, for instance, tweeting about their frustration or something. So maybe he's frustrated.
But but footballers live in the real world. This is a different world. This is a complete bizarro world, to use one of Vince's phrases, isn't it?
It's bizarro world. And finally, the one last bit of news I want to talk about. Batista is come out apparently saying he would love to have a full-time return to WWE.
Which is odd, isn't it? Because I thought he was doing well in the movies.
He is doing well in the movies.
So I don't know. But
he is. He's doing very well in movies.
But where does he fit in 2017?
Blue Batista might be welcome back.
It's the kind of thing who'd come back for a WrestleMania run or whatever. But he's not necessarily a Jericho, is he? I mean, he was all right. You know, he's...
But he's just the same character, isn't he, really? He's not... That's the thing about Jericho. He's managed to...
He can reinvent himself, can't he?
But
Yeah, I don't... I'm not saying it's a bad thing or whatever, but I just don't...
Yeah. All right, well, thank you very much, Richard. That was This Week in WWE. We'll review it again next Monday. Make sure you like, subscribe and podcast.
I'm going to see how quickly I can get through this Hall of Intercontinental Champions on WWE.com before I get to a non-picture of The Miz. No, it's The Miz. It's The Miz again.
Anyway, right. Richard, this week you've been speaking to Liam O'Rourke.
Well, yes. Well, this is where the match of the week comes from. Super Bowl 92 from WCW, and it is Flying Brian Pillman, as was, trying to win back the WCW Light Heavyweight Championship, which only lasted about a year and a half. Against the Japanese sensation, Jushin Thunder Liger, who beat him on Christmas Day 1991 for the title. I think he won it at Halloween Havoc and then lost it on Christmas Day. It's I think Meltzer gave it 4¾ stars in 1992.
Oh, Meltzer.
It's just a belty match.
Just go five. God's sake.
It's a belty match. It's one of the better Brian Pillman matches of this era. And, of course, one of his last... great matches before, as a singles match rather, before injuries and so on and so forth took over.
So that was Fall Brawl,
Super Brawl.
My apologies.
Yeah, it didn't help that they have two similar names. Yeah, Super Brawl 2, 1992, yeah.
1992.
Opening match.
Okay. Right, let's talk a little bit about Brian Pillman.
Yes.
When I've looked at his career and things like that, obviously there's all sorts of things that come up regarding the firearm and the gun in WWE. But elsewhere, obviously, he was this whole loose cannon gimmick was very intriguing. And it sort of, you can see the way it sort of weaved the reality of what is now WWE. Sort of, you know, when I say reality, I mean it in air quotes.
Yes.
Sort of the shoot style in a way, doesn't it? He seemed a bit ahead of his time in a way. But as Liam says in the interview we'll hear, he says that, if anything, it was perfect for that time, and it was just pre-Attitude Era, wasn't it?
Yeah, because if you think about things logically, around 94, 95, internet's not a big thing, as we mentioned earlier. So a lot of people, certainly over here, where I lived on ITV, you didn't get WCW. Mm. Some regions of the UK had it, but not here. So we didn't get to see much of him. And all you'd read about is what he was up to in magazines like Power Slam or whatever. So when he had his accident and reinvented himself as the loose cannon, and it was over a period of time when he went from being Flying Brian and then the Hollywood Blonde and then kind of in a bit of flux, and then was one of the Four Horsemen. But you could tell he was a bit of a rebel in that, and then became the loose cannon, and you know, managed to negotiate his way out of WCW. Become a hot free agent and have both sides bid for him, and you know, with WF and the gun angle and everything. But yeah, it's you know, CM Punk came along and did the pipe bomb or whatever, but we all know now. We all knew what the situation was because we all read the newsletters. We're all on the internet in 1994.
But there's similarities, isn't there?
Yeah. For most of us in 1994, we didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. We didn't know the ins and outs of things. Well, so this almost seemed like real when everything else, you know, when you've got Jim Duggan running around with his 2x4 and whatever, and Hulk Hogan fighting Brutus the Butcher Beefcake, or whatever he's called at the time, and a shark and an avalanche, you know, whatever. This seemed real when all the other stuff seemed fake. Even though, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
But you don't realise that. That was the intrigue, and I think that's why a lot of people, 20 years after his death, are still fascinated by Brian Pillman, who was a great wrestler before the injuries and then reinvented himself into this amazing, groundbreaking character.
The Hollywood Blondes.
Mm.
He teamed up with arguably one of the greats of
wrestling. Were a great tag team, but it lasted a very short period of time.
Before he was Stone Cold, he was Stunning Steve Austin. Steve. And they were known as the Hollywood Blondes. This must have been one of the hottest teams. You think of the you know, real talent now. Looking back, that must have been insane.
Starting together. And only lasted
a year, maybe.
Yeah, less than a year. Won the titles, the WCW and NWA World Tag Team titles. And had great matches, great segments. A great segment where they take the mickey out of Ric Flair, saying he's old. I think I'm sure they'll be on the network somewhere. Or on YouTube with Brian Pillman as Ric Flair and Steve Austin trying to be Arn Anderson.
Yeah,
he still had the hair at that point, so it kind of spoiled it. But, no, they were very good, and they were, again, one of these teams, and both of them, because obviously we saw what happened with Steve Austin in the end.
Just real star talent.
Ruined by WCW because they didn't know what to do with them.
No. So and the thing is, they had a thing with ECW, didn't they, at the time?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you had talent to go over. So he got to experience ECW. When he came back, he was with the Four Horsemen, and that's where the sort of the loose cannon started coming in, because wasn't he worrying like Arn Anderson on storyline and things like that with what he was doing?
Yeah.
Now, imagine getting to work with Ric Flair, Arn Anderson.
Yeah.
And at the time, again, Chris Benoit. Things like that. So the Four Horsemen at the time, the reincarnation of it, that must have been awesome in 95.
I said I wasn't watching WCW, but I lied, because I was recording the pay-per-views on German TV, because you get German channels on Sky at the time. So you're watching it, but it's in German. I can't remember if it was 4 Brawl 95 or something, where there's a great match between Arn Anderson and Ric Flair, where Pillman interferes and costs Flair the win and goes with Arn Anderson. But obviously it's all a ruse. It probably ends up with beating Sting, I can't remember in the end. But yeah, he was just doing weird things like making Bobby Heenan say, "What the fuck are you doing?" That kind of thing.
Yeah, because he grabbed him, didn't he?
Yeah, and he didn't expect it, and Heenan had a neck injury. So
And he said... and
he stormed off,
Liam mentions it in the in the interview where he says something on I respect you, Booker Man.
Yeah, yeah, to Kevin Sullivan.
In the 90s, no one knew. Exactly. There were still areas, I imagine, where people were still thinking that this might be real and things like that. So that's insane. And the sort of the loose cannon element then went to WWE.
Yeah, and before it went to WWE, he said he was going to get his out and have a wee in the ring. I've said fuck, I don't know why I can't say, you know, penis, but there you go.
Proper penis on proper spot.
So, you know, and did lots of things like that. But, you know, the problem was for Pillman, he had this hot character, but he had the crash, destroyed his ankle, couldn't work the way he did in the past. And sadly, you know, his WWE run, WWF run rather at the time, didn't really do much in the ring, was a big character, of course, out of the ring. And we mentioned the gun angle, which is legendary.
It is, yeah. It's bold even then. Yeah. Now it's still bold.
They'd never do it again now.
Never. They couldn't get away with it.
But, yeah, it was... it's one of those, what would have happened if he was still around today? What would he be doing today?
Well, he'd be, what, 55? He'd be 55, so I don't think, obviously, he'd be doing too much. Maybe he'd be booking, but maybe he'd be working with talent. Maybe he'd be saying that, you know, go with these sort of things. Do you know what I mean?
He did a bit of commentary, and he was always charismatic. He could have been a manager or something, although Vince doesn't like managers. I'm sure he'd be doing something.
Well, this is the thing, though. If you are intrigued, maybe have a listen to this interview with Liam O'Rourke, the author of Crazy Like a Fox, 20 years on from... the death of Brian Pillman. Chronologically, that's not the right word, but is he
chronicling?
His career.
I got the word wrong loads of times yesterday.
And Richard was having a chat with him on Proper Spot Does WWE.
You've been able to speak to many and various people from all walks of his life, from Kim Wood, from his football career, and obviously his family himself, from the likes of Raven and Jim Cornette, who've worked with him in wrestling, and outside of the business, but inside the business, in Mark Madden and Dave Meltzer. What was the biggest thing you'd learned, perhaps, about Brian Pillman that you didn't know before you wrote the book?
Oh, wow. That's probably going to be the toughest question that you asked me today, I think, because... there was just so much, you know, there was so much. I think that's the thing with, and it's kind of what kind of encouraged me to do this whole book in the first place, was that there is a general knowledge, I think, of Brian Pillman's story. But the thing that interested me and always has done was that when you kind of scratch beneath the surface, there's always a different layer and there's always a different detail. And then when you scratch beneath that, there's even more. And then even more, it's like the most layered onion of a story that you could possibly imagine. And I think in terms of what was the biggest thing to learn, it's difficult, but I think that one of the things that really kind of stood out for me was just how well he was able to kind of read people and read the environment. And again, it's more just kind of understanding Brian's intelligence has been kind of one of the biggest points of learning throughout this entire thing, because when I would talk to people, they would always have a different take on the way Brian was with them. You know, I would talk to, you know, Kim Wood, who has all these incredible stories about, you know, him in the Bengals, him trying to make the Bengals, and, you know, stories about him fighting people and stories about him with women. And then I'll talk to, like, Colin Bowman, who's a Glaswegian, who worked for WCW Magazine, who's the editor for a number of years. And I would kind of start the conversation by saying something like how, you know, I understand that Brian had a very wild personality. And then he would come back and say something like, well, yes, but at the same time, I never saw as much of that as other people did because he was different with me. And then when I was talking to Dave Meltzer, the Wrestling Observer Newsletter, one of the things that Dave pointed out was that if he wanted to tell a story about, you know, a woman that he's been with or something sensational that's happened, he would call Mark Madden because that was Mark Madden's personality. But if he wanted to talk about Luther's at 4 o'clock in the morning, he'd call Dave Meltzer. You know, he had different people for different things, and it was almost this kind of sixth sense that he had, an ability to read people and kind of know what appealed to them and know how to be with different people. And you know, one of the kind of the big overriding themes of the book is Brian's ability to navigate certain situations based on his ability to read people. And it's like he could see what appealed to people, he knew how to appeal to them specifically, and he would kind of play on that to kind of advance. And it wasn't necessarily, you know, being manipulative, it was just the sense of, okay, I know that what will speak to this person the best, just from being around them a little bit, will be this. And again, it's just, it harkens back to that intelligence, and you hear it a lot, but it really kind of stands out with Brian. I think it really comes through in the book, is just how much of a scholar he was, and between a natural intelligence and just a desire to always learn, you know. And that's something that I think really kind of stands out when you kind of contrast this to the modern day, where there are tons of people who are students of the game, but Brian's almost a student in a different sense, in that he would always try new things, and he would always gamble. He would always, you know, if you kind of consider the landscape in the early 90s in WCW, the idea of, I'm going to lobby to bring in Jushin Liger, this guy from Japan, who everybody on the underground knows who he is and knows how good he is, but the general American wrestling business does not know this complete stranger, but I'm going to bring him in and bank my own career on bringing this guy in and working with him, because on the off chance that it will work out for me. You know, it's like he would always take risks, he would always take gambles, and I think one of those, and that kind of, again, it's the thing of his entire career, the amount of research he did to kind of make the loose cannon perfect. I mean, it was a 24-hour-a-day thing for him, that knowledge gathering and kind of that instinctual intelligence. That really kind of stands out in this book.
And I guess the loose cannon character, you mentioned intelligence, it's the intelligence to know exactly the situation within the wrestling industry at that point in the mid-90s. It was the perfect time for that kind of character.
Yeah, but it really was. The perfect character for the perfect time. Which is funny because I always kind of, you would hear those whispers from fans about how Brian Pillman was so ahead of his time. But at the same time, I always kind of had that kind of niggling thing in my head of what you just said, Richard, which is, I actually think that it was the perfect gimmick for the perfect time. I think he was the master of the time he was in many ways, because if you tried to do that now, you could do it to a degree, and CM Punk pretty much replicated the entire thing in 2011 when he was doing the shoot interviews and the pipe bomb and all that stuff. And it did capture the imagination because, you know, the wrestling audience has changed. You know, that kind of, there's a bit more of a kind of proliferation, I suppose, of people knowing what's going on the inside of the business. But back then, it was right at the cusp of when that started to happen. You know, the internet in 96 wasn't what it is now. But at that time, there were certainly pockets of smarter wrestling fans, let's put it that way. People who knew what was really going on, kind of understood how the backstage machinations kind of worked. And there was a desire to kind of learn more, and a desire to know more from the fans. And I think that one of the interesting things about that whole loose cannon thing with Pillman is the avenues he went to appeal to that small fan base. And by percentage at the time, it was a small percentage. Yeah, but, you know, things he would do on AOL, you know, things he would do in ECW, it's all underground. You know, things to appeal to newsletters and hotlines. Like, you know, the famous one, obviously, is him and Kevin Sullivan with the I Respect You Booker Man. But when you think about it, at that time, how many people really knew what a Booker Man was? You know, by percentage, he said it now, a lot of, you know, the percentage is way higher. Back then, the percentage is minimal. But again, it all ties into the intelligence of Pillman to kind of understand that even if that percentage at the time was really small, that percentage was a very, very loud voice at the time, you know, because WCW and the WWF are right at the start of the Monday Night War. Raw and Nitro head-to-head every Monday, and neither company had broken ahead yet. They were very even. It was a level playing field, and both sides were looking for anything to kind of indicate that this, you know, if you go in this direction, this will push you ahead a little bit further. And all these avenues that Pillman took, it was a calculated attempt to get all these people talking about him, so that whether it be Bischoff or McMahon, even if they weren't completely listening to those fans, they could still hear them. They could hear the noise, and Pillman was making a lot of noise during that period.
And played both sides off against each other to get that contract with WWF at the time as well.
Which is brilliant. It's one of the most brilliant things, because he'd always had. I mean, the thing is with Pillman, he always did get pretty good contracts. Relative to, I think that's kind of one of the unspoken, you know, not necessarily needed to be spoken things, is it's not like he was ever getting shortchanged in his deals. You know, I mean, when he got first signed to WCW, he was getting $2,000 a week. And for a guy 2-3 years in the business at that point, $2,000 a week's pretty damn good. I mean, that's like, he got there, he got to a pretty good level pretty quick. Kip Fry offered him $225,000 a year in 1992. He got pretty much that same deal for the next 4 years. And then when he finally came to that loose cannon, he wanted more. He wanted a bigger contract. And you could argue that he probably deserved and probably should have had a bigger deal earlier than he did, because obviously he merited it, certainly. But it was that thing of, they weren't going to push him to the top. They were never going to give him the chance. And he had to find a way to make his own break. And I think, you know, one of the big things that he was able to cotton onto, and I think a lot of guys did, he wasn't the only one, but he saw Luger, and he always had that thing with Luger, and I'm sure you've heard it before, that he resented the fact that Lex would always get big contracts, no matter what the situation. He always managed to find a way to play the situation so well. You know, like, it started back in 1987 with Lex, when Jim Crockett's offering him, you know, $350,000 a year based on potential, because there's a fear he was going to go to the WWF. You know, in 1995, that first Nitro, Lex Luger was kind of considered a bit of a WWF washout. You know, he'd failed as a top guy in the WWF, and Bischoff initially didn't want him until he saw the value of, the shock move to establish Nitro. All of a sudden, he was so valuable, and Bischoff kind of went against his own initial small offer for Lex, and really kind of threw a lot of the cards on the table and gave him a huge offer. And Pillman just took one look at that and couldn't believe it. It's just like, this guy's just proven that he can't play at the big level, and he can't deliver, but you're going to give him a big contract anyway, and therefore he's going to get treated like a top star. And that was obviously Pillman's big thing. It was something I was kind of trying to get to the bottom of when I was interviewing guys. Like, was it about, because you always hear that Brian was very business-oriented. It was about the money. But at the same time, there was a pride about trying to be a main eventer. And, his natural attitude, and he kind of had an alpha male personality anyway. It had to drive him crazy that no matter what happened, he couldn't get the position he wanted or the money he wanted. And he figured out a way where, this will be the way to get the money I want, which will then translate into me getting the position I want, because with one comes the other.
There's so many facets of his in-ring career. There's so much to get involved with. I can't wait to read the book, such as, he's running the Four Horsemen, which was a dead duck after the 93 incarnation with Paul Roma. But he and Chris Benoit, dare we say his name, revitalized the Four Horsemen, and then he was killed off by WCW again. But so many things that he was involved with in his career. And of course, the loose cannon persona, he had to reinvent himself because of those out-of-the-ring injuries, which meant he couldn't go anymore.
Yeah, well, it was one of those things that kind of worked. It kind of played on itself in a strange way, because he was physically banged up anyway before the accident. I mean, he had problems with his back dating back to 1991. He had a lot of muscle injuries. He tore his tricep in Stampede. He tore his hamstring in the Bengals. There's a lot of injuries that he broke his wrist. There's a lot of stuff that he did that, he was feeling it. By 1995, he was feeling it. And he kind of knew. It's one of the things that, again, it came out in the book, and in speaking to Dave Meltzer, Meltzer said to me that he had a conversation with Brian where Brian went to Japan in, June of 95 to do the Best of the Super Juniors tournament. It's like an annual tournament where they bring in all these, junior heavyweights from around the world. And New Japan had the business relationship with WCW. So they had Pillman go over, they had Alex Wright go over. But also, you got a lot of the guys who are already in New Japan, like Benoit and Malenko and Guerrero. Guys that would eventually, in a not too distant future, came to WCW. And so what ended up happening was, Pillman's working with these guys, and all of a sudden, he kind of realizes that what had been his calling card, it was like his fail-safe, like you say, was that he was very good in the ring, and he was considered very good in the ring. He wouldn't really be often given chances to show his personality, and at that point in 95, he hadn't been given a chance to show his personality since the Hollywood Blondes in 93, before they got broke up. So it'd been about a year and a half, and he really was, I think it was a bit of a rude awakening for him on that tour, because when that tour was finished, he came back and he called Dave Meltzer, and he basically just said, look, these guys are so good. I mean, I'm sure you know when you see them, but it's different working with them. When you work with them, you understand how good these guys are. And he knew they were coming in. And at the same time, he was a student of the game, and he saw Rey Mysterio Jr., who was picking up steam. And he just thought, I can't be flying Brian as soon as Rey Mysterio gets picked up. And Rey will get picked up. He knew it before most that Rey was going to be big in America. And he just thought, I'm going to be made obsolete. My one calling card is going to be made obsolete. So what I'm going to have to do is, I'm going to have to become a character. I'm going to have to do something that's different. So I'm not just known for being a good wrestler. And of course, he plays on all these kind of things. And as we go into him in the book, he goes so deep into the loose cannon character that he basically becomes the loose cannon character in real life and starts making these decisions and starts doing these really impulsive things that are really kind of, you know, they kind of counter what the original idea of the gimmick was, which was to work the world and pretend to be something that he really wasn't just to get people talking. Well, as time went by, you know, he was living it so much, it's one of those things, and it's kind of like one of the tragic tales of and you hear about that a lot with actors. You know, Heath Ledger was similar when he tried to be the Joker for The Dark Knight, and he ended up researching the character so much that he put himself in a depression. You know, it's like you read about that kind of thing a lot, and it happened with Brian, where he had a lot of traumatic things happen in his life, but he ended up pretty much kind of diving into it. I don't know if it was escapism, I don't know if it was just, you know, he was so obsessed. And he knew he was onto a winner, but he became the loose cannon in real life very much. And then when the accident happened, which is kind of a direct result of that, it was one of those things where, like you say, he had to ramp up the loose cannon element of his act because he couldn't really do anything in the ring anymore. You know, it's such an, if he thought he was going to be limited compared to the likes of Guerrero and Mysterio, he was limited by anybody's standards after the Humvee wreck. He really should have. He shouldn't have come back. In truth.
And I guess in terms of his WWF career, there's not really much to talk about. It's in the ring, but out of the ring, obviously, there's the famous gun angle on Raw, which will be talked about till the end of time. And the fact that he has added a great word to the wrestling lexicon in someone's ankle being pilmanized, which people still use to this day, which is a superb word, but obviously not the best of words.
And that was interesting too, because, you know, everything that was going on at the time, he was getting a lot of pressure from, I mean, he had self-imposed pressure anyway to come back. You know, he hated the fact that, I mean, really hated the fact that he had that injury when he did. I mean, like, I don't think there's any way, even in a book, to put into words just, you know, what other people, I had so many people tell me that in conversations they had with Brian, he was distraught. He was just, you know, it was one of those things where you can just see the desolation in somebody's face when they talk about it, because it's like this helplessness. And again, you almost kind of, to overcompensate for that, they would do these things like, okay, let's see, we haven't had Pillman do all that much for the first 3 or 4 months of this contract. And you know, the guys were talking about it, but wrestlers weren't happy, you know, because they've been dealing with years of WWF's, you know, peculiar contracts where you get given an opportunity and no guaranteed money. And here's Brian with this great huge guarantee, you know, kind of strolling the door and not really doing much for the first 3 or 4 months because he couldn't. And then so what you were getting in response is Vince would say, well, let's do something big. Let's justify it, which is kind of exactly what Pillman wanted all along. And then you get stuff like the gun angle, but yeah, which is, like you said, is going to be talked about until the end of time. And the kind of strange thing about it is it really, at the time, it made a big noise, certainly. But it wasn't like it was something that really made a huge dent in the landscape, other than it got a lot of people talking for a few weeks. But at the same time, it's one of those things, again, it's bizarre, it's endured. You know, like you mentioned, it's going to get talked about forever, the time that Brian Pillman pulled a gun on Raw, live. You know, it's pretty insane when you think about it now. Can you imagine someone doing that now?
Well, until he gets it'd probably be more negative interest these days than he would have done in the late 90s.
Yeah.
I guess if things get desperate, you'd hope they wouldn't.
You'd hope they wouldn't. And again, tenor of the times, it was one of those things where, and it actually kind of goes a lot. It's almost like a strange, it feels like another world. You know, if you're watching at that time, it really does feel like another planet to watch wrestling and kind of follow, you know, go back and look at the news in 97 and 98 and 99 in wrestling and just seeing, first of all, how quick everything moved. And secondly, how almost rash so many of the decisions were, because week to week, it was like on everybody's mind constantly that we're in this war and we need to find anything, whether it be large, whether it be small, we need to find anything that's going to help us along, because whether WCW wants to increase their lead when they took over at first, or whether WWF's trying to find a way to get back in the fight, nothing seems like it's working. I mean, that leads to a lot of the decisions, and pretty much was the crux behind, okay, the Raw time slot's changing, we need something big. Brian, we're going to have you pull out a gun on live TV, you know? It's like it's a totally different world of thinking to now, where you've got 3 hours, and they'll put, you know, a lot of things on that really you think, what are they doing putting this in the main event? you know, now it seems like they don't really calculate things all that much or put that much importance on 1 week. Back then, every week was life and death.
I think as we say often when we review Raw, we say it was on for 3 hours and some stuff happened, and that's about it. it just seems to. I watch it on fast forward most weeks, just waiting for something to appear, or I've already listened to a review or whatever. But you mentioned chasing ratings, and I guess sadly, his death turns into that. Obviously, you found dead in his hotel room on the 5th of October in 1997, but the day after on Raw and in subsequent weeks, I think of all the things we can blame WWE Astro Vince McMahon for that they've done over however many years, the interview with his wife Melanie the day after and in subsequent weeks, that must be up there with one of the worst things they've done.
Yeah, I think you've probably summed that up better than most could. I think there's a lot to that too. That's a very strange deal, because when you get the book, I'd love to know what you think, Richard, just about that last few months of his life, because when that whole thing happened with Melanie, and I hate that too, and you know, you look at it and it's like the way they zoom in on the face and you have Vincent Mann asking, have you had any chance to think about what you, now as a single parent, are going to do to provide for your five children? And it's just like, what do you want out of this? Like, and the way they built it up the whole show, you know, it's like, coming up next, or coming up later, you know, we're going to be talking to the widow. And it's just like, it's so chilling, and it's so vile. And then you kind of learn, again, you kind of peel beneath the surface, and you realize that, you know, Melanie and Brian, they were not getting along at the end at all. I mean, for the last few months, I mean, they were going through a very, very, very trying divorce, and there were a lot of things happening on both sides, not just Melanie's front, not just Brian's front, where it was volatile and it wasn't good, and it was a situation where people who I spoke to who knew said that something bad was going to happen there between those two, you know, one way or the other, it wasn't going to end well. And so I think, yeah, what was one of the things where you always kind of, I always looked at that whole thing with Melanie the day after on Raw as, how can Vince be so manipulative to do something like that? Have to be so cold-hearted. And I agree, and it is. It is, no matter how you look at it. It's the sleaziest thing. And then, again, you peel beneath the surface, and it's almost like, it almost makes it feel even more kind of hollow, I guess. I don't know. It's just, you look at it, you see it for what it is. It's deplorable no matter what angle you look at it. And the fact that they even, I can't even comprehend them doing it again. You look at the tenor of the times and you look at the modern day, it speaks to how desperate they were that they would do something like that. Whether it be damage control, because it was obviously one of the first major deaths on their roster of a major star. They'd had other people die. Rick McGraw had died when he was under contract. But this is the first one where it was like, here's a guy who's a current star and he's just died. He's being featured heavily and he's died, and we think it's drugs, but we don't know yet. And at that point, they didn't know. They didn't know what the cause of death was at the time. They assumed overdose because they'd had all the stories and they knew what was going on with Brian. They knew he was having problems. And then, like I said, it's damage control. And Bruce Pritchard had mentioned something on his podcast about how, for anybody who second guesses the fact we did that, you know, F you. And it's like, you know what? No, sorry. 20 years later, it still comes off as callous and sleazy and cheap and desperate as it did back then. If anything, more so, because as you learn, and as you'll read in the book, everybody in that, there were no innocent parties in this thing. It all comes off terrible. It's just disgusting.
I guess the worst thing is that they had time to plan, whereas with Owen Hart's death, they didn't have time. It was just a spur-of-the-moment decision. And whether you think it's right or wrong, at least you can have that as an excuse for that, I guess, in a sense.
Yeah, you're right. That's one of those things, because when Owen died, you hear all that, they carried on the show. They carried on the show. Should they have carried on the show? And it's like, I always think, and I wrote this in a book about this situation, which is that in the aftermath of someone's death, especially if it's a shock death, like an Owen, like no one can predict, you know? And to a degree, even though Brian was, you know, everyone knew that Brian was in rough shape, and some people were saying, you know, we need to be really careful about Brian. It wasn't like anybody expected it, you know what I mean? But with Owen, because it was on the fly, it's like, I can't say Like I said, I wrote in the book, anything when it's a shock death, in the first 24 hours afterwards, I always kind of give a bit of a benefit of the doubt because I'm not in that situation. I'm not the one who has to make the decision. And when something like that just is that's so surreal, we've all had those moments in our life, whether it be a loved one dying or someone breaking bad news or something like that, where it just completely throws you for a loop. And all of a sudden, the world just feels completely different. You know what I mean? It's like it really kind of shakes you up. It's like in that kind of erratic moment of your brain trying to process the news, you know, maybe you don't make the best decisions. You know, maybe you don't make the best calls. You know, letting the show go on with Owen, probably not the best call. But again, it's made under duress. You know, so you always got to think there's a bit of a benefit of the doubt. But this was 24 hours later. And again, you know, 24 hours is not the longest time to get over something. But from Vince's perspective, the idea of this shocking thing's happened, how do we deal with it? Let's call up the widow and put her on television so I can ask her how she's going to provide for her kids. That's just that's the lowest of the low. And it is one of the lowest moments in the history of the company, I think.
Now, thankfully, you would hope that things have... lessons have been learnt in the prior 20 or the 20 years following Brian Pillman's death. What would you say would his legacy have been on the wrestling industry today?
Oh, wow. Well, this is the thing. I mean, one of the more kind of interesting and longest debates you can have is the what if, the what could have been discussion. You know what I mean? Like, if he hadn't died, where would he have ended up? What would have his legacy been? What would have happened if he didn't have the wreck when he did, you know? There's so many different elements to that that you can really get into. You can spend hours talking about that and thinking about that. But when you actually look at, you know, the legacy that he did have, and you're 2 decades on, what legacy did he have? I think that you've got a lot of change in the business that kind of happened with him at the forefront. And I think the thing that's kind of tough to gauge is whether or not those changes would have happened anyway, and he knew it, and he was just on the crest of the wave and knew that he was going to be the first. Or if it was something that kind of came along because of what he did. Because consider that before Brian did that whole thing in WCW with the loose cannon and the Booker Man tying into reality, it wasn't like playing into the reality of wrestling was something that either WCW or the WWF did. You know, WWF at the time had, you know, dentists and pirates and school teachers and, you know, and gimmicks. WCW had the Dungeon of Doom. So everybody's still stuck in this mentality of we've got to play pretend. And ECW was doing stuff that was far more real and far more kind of to the, you know, cutting to the bone type of stuff. But neither WCW or the WWF were really kind of, you know, taking it and appropriating it for themselves yet. And Brian was the first to really kind of bring a bit of reality into wrestling, you know, especially, you know, for the first time in a while anyway. You know, bringing, you know, elements of, you know, he's fighting with the company, he's fighting with the booker, we think that there's problems here. You'll be saying, you know, Booker Man and Smart Marks and all this stuff. And, it was kind of a, like you say, a knock-on effect. I'm not sure, maybe, but as a result of this, and because of the amount of noise that it made and the amount of attention it attracted, you know, when they first brought in the NWO, there were so many elements of real life and, you know, kind of mentioning where you come from and the names involved that I'm not sure that they would have necessarily done if it wasn't for the fact that they'd done it first with Pillman. You know, the whole Montreal screw job and the reaction to that, where Vince just decides he's going to put on the air that, you know, he, you know, this thing happened, the time honored traditions, and, you know, he didn't want to lose and stuff like that, and becoming Mr. McMahon. I mean, these big angles that happened, they have roots in the fact that they dealt with reality. And that was something that Brian introduced to the big two. Like I said, ECW were doing it, but it was about, you know, it getting into WCW and kind of people feeling that if you did it on a main stage, it could work, and yeah, it can translate. Now, of course, there were about 1,000 attempts at other things that didn't work nearly as well. But I think that when you actually kind of look at, you know, the influence of Brian, it's like you can look at the cruiserweights today and say, would there have been a cruiserweight division now? Rightly or wrongly, of course, they're not doing a great job with it. But would it have even happened if it wasn't for Brian pitching for the light heavyweight division back in '91? You know, would the cruiserweight division in 96 have happened if it wasn't for the fact that Pillman in early 95 was lobbying to bring it back and say, you know, I'll be a heel and build it around me. And then we can bring in Benoit and Sabu, who had, you know, a big rep at the time in ECW. We can bring in guys from Mexico because he's a big Lucha fan. He wanted to work with Super Astro. You know, you have all these different elements of Brian where he kind of, in an inadvertent way, it might have happened anyway, who knows. But he was right on the crest of the wave with so many things. And you look at right now where, you know, the size barrier has changed in wrestling. And it's one of those kind of sad things where you're like, and I think Raven in the book, he put it best when he said, if Brian had come along 20 years later, the size issue changed so dramatically, he'd have been a top guy. If he'd have come along 20 years earlier, he would have been on top of all the small territories because he was the kind of guy you could build around. You know, the old bookers used to say that the perfect babyface was a guy that guys wanted to hang out with and women wanted to be with. And that was Brian in real life. And it wasn't like it was a, you know, even a character he had to portray. He had a very boisterous, gregarious, natural personality in the real world. And there's a lot of stories about that in the book too, which are just ridiculous. But yeah, in terms of the influence on the business, I'm not sure that it would look, I think it would look very different right now if it wasn't for Brian, because you know, I think the size issue changed because of him. I think the reality in wrestling changed because of him. And yeah, I just think it would be a very different landscape right now. I'm not sure how it would look.
Life would be very dull if we didn't have what if questions to answer, I guess. And the book is called Crazy Like a Fox. You must be very pleased, by the way, that Alicia Fox is wearing your book title on her T-shirts at the moment. It's a nice free publicity for you.
I love the free publicity. I got to be honest with you, Richard. And it's funny because I came up with a game. I was considering about five or six different titles for the book until eventually it's like, you know what? It needs to be, because one of the overriding themes of the book is that there's this intermixing of good and bad in Brian's real and professional life. You know, it's like there's high points, there's low points, there's good, there's bad. He's intelligent, but he acts impulsive. He's a complex guy, but he can act very simple. And it's like, I need something that really encapsulates it. So, you know what? Crazy Like a Fox kind of says it all. I think that's kind of perfect. And then I make the press release. That's what it's going to be called, you know, 20 years after the day of his death. We announce the book's coming out. And then about 3 days later, this T-shirt comes out that says Crazy Like a Fox for Alicia Fox. And I just, yeah, you kind of, it's like, well, you know what, if you want to billboard it, that's fine with me.
Have you bought the T-shirt? That's the main question.
I haven't. I got to be honest, I haven't. Maybe someone can send it to me for Christmas and I'll be over the moon. But until that day, I think I'll stick with the copies of the book.
Liam O'Rourke there, the author of Crazy Like a Fox, the story about Brian Pillman, and thoroughly enjoyable interview, Richard. You did a good job there, mate.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it, and Liam's a good talker, and obviously he's got his own podcast at Squared Circle Gazette, which I love listening to, and the book's fascinating. I'm getting it for Christmas.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to wait a while, but I'm really looking forward to reading it.
Yeah. I'm excited to hopefully try and get you to give me it afterwards.
Oh, I'm sure I'll be able to lend you it.
But yeah, again, thanks to Liam, and thank you very much for listening to the podcast. We're here every week. Every Monday we'll chat about WWE, what's been happening, what's going on, and things of that nature. Thank you very much for listening. Richard, anything else you want to say?
No, I don't think so. It's...
Oh, where can you get the book, by the way?
Amazon, usual places.
Go Amazon. Yeah, we're all done then.
Well, get your local bookshop to order it, because they deserve the money more.
Yeah, it's true, actually. Yeah.
Probably pay more tax.
Richard, have yourself a good week, mate.
Thank you, you too.
And the listener, thank you very much for listening. We'll see you again next week.